Welcome to True Crime in the Low Country, where we explore the darkest corners of the region's criminal history. Join host Frank Santarella and co-hosts Crime and Cask, Jim Cask, and Elaine Greenwood of Superwoke News as they dissect the chilling details of the Murdaugh murder trial, a case that has gripped the nation and exposed years of fraud, deception, and tragedy. It's True Crime in the Low Country, and the truth is just around the corner.
All right, Jonathan's got us on, and this is WVFF 97.7 LPFM, Red Brick Patriot Radio, and this is True Crime in the Low Country with the, I gotta say illustrious. Illustrious Elaine Greenwood.
I'm begging you not to.
Oh, all right. Rewind. Elaine Greenwood of Super Woke News. And Jim Cask from Crime and Cask. Hey, do I know you guys? Have we ever done this before?
Oh, I don't think so, no.
Oh, God,
well,
help us.
One of us is late, so that excuses a lot of
oh,
it.
Oh, no. You don't know. It's been crazy. I fell asleep in the chair when I got home because I was down the boat, right? So I fell asleep in the chair. I woke up. I said, holy see what time it is. All right, so I go and I had to feed my pets. So I go down the road, feed my pets, and I drive like a madman here. And then I get a text from you saying, oh, let's wait 20 minutes. Okay, great. So now here we are. Anyway.
I'm sorry.
No.
It's just
a... Listen.
Well, you're in the hospital.
Life,
what am I going to do?
Life happens. Mr. Jim, you get to, what do you call it? You get to moan on us now. What troubles did you have today?
I really didn't have too much trouble today. Lane's always giving me trouble, so I have to deal with that on a daily basis. But that's
all right. Good. And listen, that's her place in life. Anyway.
That's right.
Yeah, I know. Anyway. Where did we leave off last time?
Oh, Lord, where did we leave off?
We were talking about Alan Wilson, and you're still connecting the dots between Alan Wilson and...
No.
Well, we're going to morph into...
It's not Alan Wilson. Alan Wilson is the Attorney General.
That's true. Okay, so let's say it's Patrick Wilson.
Thank you. Before we get some kind of slander suit. Holy smokes.
Well, I don't think Alan will sue it. He loves us. We're nice people. But you're right. It's Patrick Wilson. It sounds like what?
Elaine needs a nap.
Seriously, you guys. Yes. Okay, so anyway. Jim has just phenomenal reporting about Patrick Wilson and this interview, this exclusive interview he has with Patrick Wilson that is just groundbreaking. It is absolutely amazing. It really, I think that people have said this about Jim's reporting about this. It pulls all the pieces together. I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but it pulls all the pieces together and answers a lot of questions about this connection between some of these cases that were not the ones that made the connection. Media made the connection. Certainly Netflix made the connection, or Fitz News did, with connecting the hit-and-run death of Stephen Smith and then the accident with Gloria Satterfield and then the boat crash accident and the deaths of Paul and Maggie. And there are some connections that have to do with these kids, and Patrick Wilson is one of them, and Sean Connolly is another, but they are... they're all connected in a very interesting way. So take it away, Jim. Go.
Yeah, listen, and I've been working on the fourth article now for the Patrick Wilson interview that I did back in August of 2024. It is groundbreaking. And this third one that I posted on Monday is going to shatter everything you thought about anything to do with Elvis.
All right, Jim, tell us where we can find these articles.
They're at crimeandcask.com, or if you want to go to ccnewsnetwork.com, either one, or just Google Crime and Cask and you'll find it. You'll see it. It's a brand new website. It's beautiful.
All right. Are these behind a paywall?
No, they're all free.
Oh, my. Listen, I'll tell you what. You guys take care of this. I'm going to go listen to Jim's thing. No, I'm only kidding. No, that's great. That's great.
Enjoy your nap. Come back in 15 minutes.
Yeah. No, that's great.
No, come back.
That is great. And that's a hell of a service that you're offering, Jim. And it's a hell of a service that you guys, both of you, are doing here. Now, tell us.
Let's get back to Stephen Smith.
Yes.
Stephen Smith. Okay, I've been investigating this for a long time, and I know a lot of people out there have been investigating it for a long time as well. However, I looked at some of the big questions that were asked, and one of the biggest questions that was asked was, why was his car on the side of the road? So Stephen Smith's car, it was a 2013 Chevy Aveo, and there's a lot of people that have investigated this case, and a lot of smart people get that. However, I look at things differently. Elaine can tell you that. Frank, you've listened to me long enough. You know that I just look at things differently. So why was his car parked off the road, off Highway 601, approximately 3 miles from where he died? But he's got gas in it. So you're thinking, well, what the heck happened? So here's really all I did.
So it was just, wait a minute, Jim, the car was not out of gas. It's just parked on the side of the road. Nobody actually investigated why was it on the side of the road if it wasn't actually out of gas.
The car was
so then you
not
took a look
gas.
At it. Right.
So in my in-depth investigation on the 2013 Chevy Aveo, that little yellow car, I discovered that particular year model car was notoriously known to have issues with something called a camshaft position sensor.
Holy mackerel. So go ahead.
That is similar to a crankshaft sensor problem. And many, many readers of the Chevy Aveo forum site, they point to the 2013 Chevy Aveo is having a faulty camshaft position sensor. Now, Frank, you say, oh boy. You tell me what you know about camshaft position sensors.
Well, listen, it's one thing that'll prevent your car from running because it throws everything out of timing. You know, automobiles are sequential operations have to be performed to have your automobile engine run. And if you knock those things out of sequence, you can spin that motor all day, and nothing's going to happen.
Oh my goodness! Engine stalling is the number one thing that can happen. So the most common symptom of the 2013 Chevy Aveo that Stephen Smith was driving, and that failing camshaft sensor, is the engine stalling or shutting off unexpectedly. And here's the big kicker: while driving.
While driving.
This happens because the engine, as Frank said, isn't receiving proper timing information. And here's the other thing, that a faulty camshaft position sensor, which is 2013 Chevy Aveo of Stevens had, is also hard to start, or there's no start. So a failing sensor can cause issues with the starting car, the engine may crank but not start, and it may take several attempts to start due to the incorrect, as Frank said, timing signals being sent to what's called the ECM, or basically the computer that runs the car. So, but how does that make any difference about Stephen Smith's car? Well, maybe some of you remember Stephen's twin sister, Stephanie. She mentioned that Stephen had called her just weeks prior to his death asking for help with his car because it wouldn't start. Now, it also had gas in it at the time, but he initially thought, and I believe she thought as well, that it was a battery issue. However, the Chevy Aveo's well-known issues with the camshaft position sensor, the car stalling by the side of the road, that aligns exactly with what happened to Stephen Smith's car. The police even tried starting Stephen Smith's car, and they didn't have any luck. But nobody... No one, not the police, not the highway patrol, not SLED, not any reporter, not anybody except John Cask from Cask and Crime pulled this up.
Wow.
I went and investigated this thing, and that's exactly, I mean, I about fell over in my chair when I'm reading this, and I'm going, oh, Lord, that's what was wrong with this kid's car, because it was notorious. I'm not talking about it was like, you know, three people had this problem. I believe it even had a recall on this particular vehicle, because you're talking about a safety issue now. It recalled and forced a recall based off of safety issues. You can't just drive a car down the road and all of a sudden have it just go out. So this thing was notorious for this, and it would shut off unexpectedly while driving. So here's the thing that I don't know, and that's, you know, a frustrated 19-year-old Stephen. Would he assume that the problem was, again, a dead battery or that he had run out of gas? We know he didn't run out of gas. But maybe he did check for gas, and I don't know. You know, he didn't look like he was a mechanic. But maybe he took the gas cap off, was trying to look, smell, maybe shake the car. I don't know. Who knows? But for whatever reason, he or someone took that gas cap and left it off. Now, if this happened in the middle of the night, maybe he was just pissed off. Maybe he just couldn't see to get it back on. Who knows what the heck happened? I don't. But And Frank, maybe you can tell me this. Is it common down there in the low country, if you happen to run out of gas on the side of the road, to leave your gas cap
out? Well, I think that's kind of like a universal signal that the car is out of gas and somebody's going to return with gas.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of intuitive, right? You know, if you just see a car there and it's abandoned, you'll think somebody walked in the woods to relieve themselves. Whereas if the gas door is open and the cap is off, you'll say, hey, somebody ran out of gas. They're going for gas. I'm not going to steal the wheels off of this car because maybe they'll be back real soon. You know, that kind of thing, you know?
So I think I solved the problem of what was wrong with the 2013 Chevy Aveo that was along the side of the road. It was a camshaft position sensor problem on that Chevy Aveo that Stephen was driving. Now, let's switch gears just a little bit in this Patrick Wilson interview, because there's an exclusive bombshell. And if you're driving right now and you're listening to this on 97.7, you might want to pull over.
Go ahead.
Because
drop it.
Yeah. Yeah, because the bombshell that Patrick Wilson, and this was after our interview was over, and he and I and his girlfriend, they were walking to their car, I was walking to mine. And we were talking about he was talking about dumb things that Paul had done.
You did these interviews face-to-face?
I did them face-to-face, and I recorded them.
Oh, Jim.
Yeah, and he knew I recorded him. In fact, I had him sign a...
Well, did he know that somebody else knew you were there? I mean, you know, with the history that these people have, I mean, they don't live in the city. Nobody can hear you scream.
We met at a little coffee shop in downtown Greenville.
All right.
So
I just want to point out, though, I did not put Frank up to saying this, but that's exactly my... My concern is I worry about my son, Jim Kask's safety when he – this is an important interview, and I think it's amazing that he got it. And you had to have so much of a wealth of background information to keep Patrick talking and to have a follow-up and to understand the context of every comment he was making. And I think you probably got him to reveal a lot more than any other interviewer would have gotten him to reveal if he'd agreed to do it. So, I'm just amazed you did it. I think you did an amazing job.
All right, Elaine, I set up the cliffhanger now. All right?
Yeah.
All right, go ahead, Jim.
Before I send it over the cliff, let me just build this up a little bit. So Wilson recounted many days of drinking, fishing, and hunting with Paul Murdoch. They were friends. They were basically, as Patrick said, they grew up together. Patrick was probably a year, maybe 2 years older than Paul, but they grew up together. And according to Wilson, Paul would often get drunk at parties and get into fights. Sometimes even putting people in the hospital, but he said there was other friends of his that were there that would help Paul get into these fights. And Paul would also drive while intoxicated, according to Wilson, and he would get into car accidents. So you got to look at, and let's look at, is he telling me the truth? Well, Connor Cook, who is also a friend of Paul Murdoch and also a friend of Patrick Wilson, has stated Paul would also get into a lot of fights. And Paul, he recalled Paul almost getting into a fight with somebody at Luther's in Buford the night of the infamous boat crash, including Paul pushing down his then-girlfriend, Morgan Daughtry, while the boat was moving. So Paul has a history of violence, according to his friends. Now, I guess we're to believe their friends, and then we know that Paul has a history of violence. But what Wilson said was that Paul would just call, and I'm quoting here, Paul would just call his daddy and granddaddy, and they'd show up. And if the police were there, his granddaddy would send them away. They knew all the cops, and they hunted on their property all the time. They'd pay off the person at the hospital or on the road. Then they'd tow his truck home, or Mr. Alex would drive it home for Paul. End quote. So this lines up exactly with what Connor Cook said in his deposition. Sued the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources concerning the boat crash and what Alex told Cook at the hospital that night of the boat crash. And he said that everything was going to be all right, Alex told Connor. He says, I just needed to keep my mouth shut and tell them I didn't know who was driving and that he's got me. That's what Cook said. Cook said he also overheard Paul calling his granddad. He says, well, we told him that he'd be in a boat wreck and whatever, and went on to say, I heard his granddad ask him who was driving and told his granddad that I was Cook. The boys in the friend group knew Paul would get the trouble. So Paul told his granddad that the old cop, Connor Cook, drove the boat. So we all know that on the third, he was Paul's granddaddy. He was a prominent legal figure, 14th solicitor, in there for 20-some years. And I asked Wilson, I said, hey, did this bother you in the friend group? I asked, you in the friend group, did this bother you guys that Paul would do this stuff and then get away with it? And he said, quote, if I did something like that, I'd be in jail. So, yeah, it bothered me that he'd get out of trouble all the time. End quote, Wilson. So here's the bombshell. We set up that Paul has got according to his friends, Paul has an evil side that he gets drunk or he gets mad, he gets in fights, he pushes people, he hits cars, he gets out of it with granddaddy and daddy. That is an MO or modus operandi that has been proven time and time again. So I'm talking to Wilson, and we're walking back to our cars. And he goes to me, he goes, the quote, and I have it on a recording. If you want to listen to that recording, it's at crimeandcask.com right now. And he says, you know I killed Gloria, right? And I stopped, and I looked at him, and I said, what did you just say? He said, Paul killed Gloria. I'm like, hold on. So I got my phone out, and I turned the microphone back on to record it, and I put it up to him. I'm like, okay. And so what you're saying is that Paul killed Gloria Satterfield. And he said, yeah, Paul killed Gloria, Satterfield. I said, well, how do you know that? He goes, well, Paul told me that several times. He says, Paul would get drunk and tell us all the time at parties or that he pushed her down the stairs. Now, he didn't kill her because, as we know, she went to the hospital. She had some pre-existing conditions, whatever it was that ended her life. Why she went into the hospital was that she was taken there by ambulance because she fell off. So she was taken to the hospital. When she was there at the hospital 2 or 3 weeks, she had poor care, whatever it was, she died. But the reason she went there, according to Wilson, Paul Murdoch pushed her off the steps.
And that Wilson goes on to say
it was no accident like Mr. Alex said it was. What's that?
Yeah, so, but Patrick Wilson is saying Paul bragged about this several times, repeatedly. Yeah.
Repeatedly.
Okay, but
yeah,
so I guess what
for others to hear.
I don't know. I guess it's fair to say, is Patrick Wilson a credible person, or does he embellish or just flat-out lie? And I think that's for people to determine for themselves. You found he's credible. I don't think you're saying that it's true, but you believe that he's credible about saying that Paul bragged about it.
Well, what I can say is that in Connor Cook's deposition, he said generally about the same thing, that he was afraid of the Murdochs because they always got out of stuff. And when he asked, what are you talking about, he said he's referring to Paul. He had heard that Paul had pushed down a housemate, and she later died. Those are exact words, housemate. I don't know. He was probably trying to think housekeeper, and he said housemate. But so Connor Cook said the same thing under oath in a deposition, that he had heard, he didn't say who he heard it from, but he said he had heard that Paul had pushed Gloria. So now you have two people from the friend group coming forward saying, one says firsthand information and the other one under sworn testimony says the same thing. Doesn't say where he got it from, though. I'm surprised.
But Connor, under sworn testimony, is evasive as all hell about aspects of
everything.
Who was driving the boat. Yeah, so I don't know if Connor's, I don't find Connor credible, whether he's under oath or not under oath. And frankly, I don't find any of those kids under oath. They were pretty clear in either December of 2018 or January of 2019 that they didn't know who was driving the boat. And then after Paul and Maggie are dead, then they suddenly have that memory that it was Paul, when Paul can't refute that. He's dead, so he can't refute it.
Right.
So, but I think it is compelling that you have Patrick Wilson sort of backing up this rumor that Paul had bragged about. And you're right, that the rumors, there are a lot of people that have spread this rumor that Paul bragged about. God, why would he do that, though? Why would he do that? Because, you know, the rest of it is he loved Gloria and
well, that's the story that is out there. So he said, and he loved Gloria, you know. And I even had one of their family members say to me, she's like, he even had a picture of Gloria in his wallet. I was like, listen, okay.
Yeah.
A picture is one thing. I know plenty of guys who've got pictures of their wives and kids in their wallets, and they're going to strip clubs or whatever they're doing. They're cheating on their girlfriend or their wives.
Well, you need to know better people, Jim. I meant to talk to you about that. You need to start knowing better people that don't do that. That's the solution to that.
And stay out of the strip clubs, damn it.
No, but I do think
these are allegations made by Patrick Wilson. Yeah. They have not been proven in a court of law or established by law enforcement. But nonetheless, Patrick told me firsthand information that he heard directly from Murdaugh. Not once, not twice, on several occasions.
Yeah.
You have to ask yourself, when this whole thing happened, right? Alex said, well, she was coming to collect a paycheck. Well, I'm going to go through this real quick, but if she was coming to collect a paycheck, she knows this family and she knows the routines, right? Supposedly she came somewhere around, I don't know, 9 o'clock or something. Takes about 20, she lived in Farnsville, I think. Takes about 20 minutes to get to the Moselle. She's not going to show up unannounced for a paycheck to Moselle and not just, you know, be there. And then it's improbable to think that Paul and Maggie were sleeping at 9 a.m., but if it all happened like Alex said it did, and of course he went on to say that he lied, but Alex goes on trying to say this, that she fell over the dogs. Okay, well, they had 4 dogs at the time. They were all hunting dogs. Now, what I know about Labradors and what I know about hunting dogs is that if you stick them outside with no fence, and there was no fence at Moselle, they are not going to be sticking around for anything.
No.
They had those dog kennels 1,100 yards away from the house, or those dogs were in the house. So somebody had to have gotten them out, right? Anyway, so and then you have to ask yourself, why was Paul home on February 1st? Because in 2018, he was a freshman at USC in Columbia. That's about 2 hours away. But there was a lot of reports, and Wilson even told me that Paul was having severe academic difficulties at the University of South Carolina.
No.
Which he also told me that because of that, in high school, Paul was taking Adderall. But it's possible that Paul was home at the estate at Murdoch because whatever issues he's having at school. And maybe she challenged Paul on him. Maybe she was giving him a hard time. Maybe she was joking about it. Who knows what the heck happened? They're both dead. But she clearly said something that made Paul mad, and he was on top of the steps when she was there, and according to Wilson and according to Connor, he pushed her off. So that changes everything, because Nautilus Insurance and Lloyd's underwriters can now potentially seek the money they paid in the wrongful death settlement because it was paid out as an accident.
Well, this is something Elaine and I have been discussing for eons.
First of all, Lloyd's, as far as we know, hasn't sued to get their, what is it, $505,000 back. They have let it go. It's Nautilus that wants their $3.8 million back, and they do make that point that if this is an intentional act, then it's not an accident. What they assert is that it's either a workman's comp claim or, worst-case scenario, an intentional act. Either way, their insurance policy doesn't cover either one, and they want the $3.8 million back. So there's no question about that. That's actually true. So Patrick could be a witness for Nautilus, except that I don't think anybody would go, touch Patrick Wilson as a witness with a 10-foot pole because he has no credibility. He'd be impeached.
But now you also have Connor Cook saying the same thing, right? So now you've got what's called hearsay, right? So let's say this hypothetical evidence that Patrick Wilson claims and that Connor Cook claims. So you've got hearsay. However,
Wait a minute. There are exceptions. Stop, Jim.
I'm going to the exceptions
to
right
hearsay.
Now.
Okay, because Paul's dead, so it's more credible. It would be admissible,
right?
Probably.
So the statement
when it gets to their credibility, yeah, right.
The statement against interest, which is Rule 804b3. I'm impressing you now. I know I am. If Paul Murdoch's statement admitted culpability, it could qualify as a statement against his penal and financial interest. But Paul's death renders him unavailable, satisfying a key condition for this exception. So what's the next one? Right? It's residual exception, Rule 807. So if Wilson and Cook's testimony is deemed highly credible and essential to the case, a judge may allow it under the residual exception, provided it has sufficient guarantees or trustworthiness. You going to believe those two kids? I don't know, but he did say it under oath.
No, but I think that the thing is that you could make an argument that neither Sean Connery or Patrick Wilson have any credibility, but we're not making that argument, and I don't – what did I say? Or Connor Cook. Connor Cook had none at all. He's impeached himself. He's not consistent at all. I don't find him credible.
So the statement's admissibility would be bolstered if corroborating evidence exists, such as inconsistencies in Murdoch's account of Satterfield's death or forensic evidence suggesting foul play. It would appear that Connor Cook has done exactly that with Wilson's statement of Paul Murdoch telling Wilson firsthand that he pushed Gloria off those 8 steps. That would be corroboration. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, that's just some legal stuff I studied because I knew I was going to be talking to you and you would call me out.
I'm just a raging person that way. But I don't think anybody is disputing Alec Murdoch for some bizarre reason that has to do with, I think, a bit of extortion, to be honest. He signed a confession of judgment for $4.3 million to the Satterfields when the $4.3 million represents the $505,000 from Lloyd's underwriters, and they're not, by the way, suing to get that back, as far as I know, and then the $3.8 million from Nautilus, and they are suing. They're alleging that's insurance fraud, and they want their money back, in which case the Satterfields were entitled to $0.00 of that $3.8 million. So why in the world? But anyway, even if it was money owed to the Satterfields, in those situations, the plaintiff doesn't get 100% of the proceeds. There's a contingency fee. So a third of it of the gross would go to the attorneys handling their claim, and then they would deduct costs and expenses, and the plaintiff would be lucky if they get even 50% of it.
Oh, you mean 50%. So Alex didn't offer to represent them out of the goodness of his heart?
Stay with us on True Crime in the Low Country. We'll be right back after this short commercial break. Don't go away.